We have a quorum. We'll bring the meeting to order. I think we have Mr. Lemke and Ms. Alderman from the zoo are going to come forward. And must have been too cold for any eagles or hawks or skunks or anything, I guess. So I don't know how that's going to work for you guys, but go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yeah, we were a little worried they'd fall off the perch and shatter this morning. So we actually have guidelines for when we take our animals out, and today was a little too cold for that.
Mr. Emke, could you introduce yourself and Ms. Alderman before you begin to speak, if you also could, and let us know your title and who you're with.
I'm Lee Emke. I'm the director of the Minnesota Zoo.
Peggy Adelman, chief financial officer at the Minnesota Zoo.
Okay, and I thought this morning, since there are some new members of this committee, we'd give you a little bit of a Zoo 101. The Minnesota Zoo, for those of you who aren't familiar, is a state agency. But we're also a partner with the Minnesota Zoo Foundation, which is a 501c3 operation, which raises private funds to support the operation and capital development at the zoo. And we've been working hand in hand now for 33 years. The zoo opened in 1978. It was a creation of the legislature and is one of only two state-owned and operated zoos in the United States. Our mission is quite straightforward. You can see on the screen up there. It's to connect people, animals, and the natural world. And we do that in a variety of ways. And from the beginning, we've really had three core program areas that are all very much interlinked. But one is conservation, one is recreation, and the other is education. I'll speak to each of those individually. Since the zoo opened in 1978, we've been well known throughout the country and, in fact, around the world as one of the leading conservation zoos. And by that, we do conservation in a number of ways. We have endangered species that are bred at our zoo as part of species survival plans in coordination with other zoos around the country and the world. We also sponsor or participate in field conservation projects in efforts to study and protect animals in nature. And those studies for the last 33 years have really covered almost the entire globe at one time or another. And in particular, our zoo is known for programs with the Amur tiger, better known as the Siberian tiger, the trumpeter swan here in Minnesota, the black rhino in Namibia, and the Asian wild horse. There are actually wild horses that were born at our zoo that are now living back in the wild in Mongolia. So our conservation history and legacy is actually quite strong, and we're very proud of it. Most people think of the zoo as a recreational activity, and we think that's great. We want people to come with their families to the zoo and enjoy themselves. But for us, the recreation mission is also an opportunity to raise revenue. We're always looking to help the bottom line. And things like the concert series at the zoo, we rent out venues at the zoo for things like wedding receptions and corporate events. We have special events at the zoo intended to draw people to come and have fun and hopefully engage with the educational messages that are at the zoo while they're here. And finally, and probably most importantly, we believe our primary role is as an environmental educator. The education at the zoo comes in many packages. The general visitor to the zoo can experience demonstrations like this one that's at the Russia's Grizzly Coast Bear exhibit. That are obviously fun and interesting, but they are part of an overall education strategy at the zoo. We work very closely with schools and teachers, school districts, individual teachers, to develop a wide palette of activities and events that allow them to do the work that they're mandated to do by their own districts. We have many programs for families and kids, scouts, anything from toddlers up to teens, many different activities that are, in some cases, part of our revenue stream, in other cases are offered as a community service. Probably our most popular educational activity is Zoo Camp, which has grown over the years into one of the most popular zoo camps in the Twin Cities. again, for many different age groups with different focuses and different activities. I hope that some of you have had your kids go through our zoo camp program at some time or another. It's often said that zoos are great for young kids, and then you kind of lose them when they're teenagers, and we've done our best to combat that with teen programs, including a wildlife conservation club, mentoring programs, career days, and as well as a teen volunteer program to continue the interest and engagement of teenagers and into their college years. And all of these education programs really come back to something we're hearing more and more about, which is STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math. Most of our programs have been and continue to touch on those areas, and really we see ourselves as a gateway to science for young kids and older kids. We have activities that we've developed, including online games, including one called Wolf Quest that was developed with a National Science Foundation grant of about $500,000, which has reached hundreds of thousands of people around the globe, and looking at ways to expand our reach beyond visitors to the zoo and doing online and other outreach activities. Probably our best-known outreach is the Zoomobile program, which takes some of our educators and some of our animals, some of whom would have been here today aside from the cold temperatures. And we reach just about every county in the state of Minnesota, serve at least 50,000 people a year through these programs, which, again, as the state zoo, we think is an important role that we've been playing. In a time when schools are more and more challenged budgetarily to have things like field trips to institutions like the zoo, we've actually been able to grow the numbers of students coming to our zoo through a program called Zoo Safari, which essentially has corporations or individuals who underwrite the entire cost of bringing an entire age group or an entire grade group from a school district to the zoo every year. It started in St. Paul. We've done this for 13 years there and has expanded to a number of other school districts and communities in the state. And many thousands of kids are now coming to the zoo, where they get transportation to the zoo, the admission, an education class, a monorail ride, and lunch, all as part of the package. And as I said, we've actually been able to grow school attendance in a time when other institutions are seeing schools cutting back on those activities. And I think this is kind of the key phrase for us. We are the largest environmental education center in the state of Minnesota. If you look at the number of people that we serve through our programs, I don't think that's the first thing that might come to mind when you think about the zoo, but that, in fact, is what we are. Operating the zoo has a significant statewide economic impact. Our operating budget for a year is about $21 million, but the most recent study that we conducted indicates that we generate about $114 million worth of direct and indirect benefit to the state through the operation of the zoo. That's up significantly from the last study we did 5 years ago, which had a $94 million impact. So you can see, even in a time of economic stagnation, we've been able to grow our impact. And this does not include the impact of the many construction projects that have been happening at the zoo in the last several years. Our goal, which was basically the original goal when the zoo was established in the 70s, was to have one of the best zoos in the world. And we've restated that. Our board a couple of years ago said we want to be known in our community and around the country as one of the top 10 zoos in America. And we believe we're now 33 years old. We're no longer the new zoo, but I think we're finally hitting our stride, and we are well on our way to, if not achieving or exceeding, that goal of being a top 10 zoo. We're hitting on all cylinders in terms of our educational impact, conservation impact, as well as the economic impact I just described. And a lot of that's come through really rethinking the visitor experience and growing the number of opportunities that people have to connect with animals at the zoo. In the last 10 years, we've opened a new exhibit just about every year, starting with the family farm back in 2000, which was entirely paid for with private money. And you can see here the number of different offerings that we've been able to add to the experience at the zoo. Most recently, this past summer, the Faces of the African Forest exhibit opened in our Tropics building. So in 10 years, essentially 10 new exhibits, with each one with a lot of impact. But we're not building just to build. Again, going back to our mission, we're doing it to make sure that people are connecting with animals and getting excited about learning. And I think the new exhibits that we've developed have really come a long way to making that much better, a much better experience and more impactful experience than perhaps the original zoo with its vast acreage and long walks between exhibits offered. And it's all been paying off. The last two fiscal years for the zoo, we've seen the highest attendance by far in the history of the zoo. FY09, we had 1.35 million people come to the zoo, our highest number ever. Fiscal year 10, we had 1.33 million. So two very strong years. We know that the opening of Russia's Grizzly Coast in 2008 probably precipitated that. That was the biggest new exhibit developed at the zoo since we opened. But we're also seeing membership growth and other revenue streams growing at the same time. The current fiscal year that we're about halfway through, we're looking to exceed 1.2 million, so a little bit down from these peak years. But with some of the new exhibits that we're planning to open up next summer, we're expecting to get back into this 1.3-plus range with attendance. And it's really a tribute to the fact that with the state support through bonding primarily, the private sector has really come to the assistance of the zoo as well and realizes the partnerships there for them are great. You can see here just a selection of some of the corporate partners that the zoo has either added or increased over the last several years. And so our private fundraising has stepped up considerably during this period of growth for the zoo. It's kind of a, with the winning team, others want to join, and we've had some great new partnerships, some of which I'll talk about in a minute, with essentially every major corporation in the state. This chart, I think, is kind of is a really key one. We are a state agency, and early in the years of the zoo, we relied primarily on the state appropriation for our funding. Back in the 80s, it was about 60% of the zoo's total budget came from the biennial appropriation. Those appropriations have declined over time, both in real terms and as a percentage of our operation, and our current projection for the upcoming year, or actually the current year, is that we're at 29% state support and 71% either earned or contributed income. So we've basically flipped the equation around from where we started out back in the 80s. And I think it's also important to note that if you look at all zoos across the country, whether they're privately owned and operated, whether they're owned and operated by a public entity like a state or a county, the average level of public support is 40% for public operating support. So that's essentially taxpayer money for the average zoo around the country is at 40%. As a state agency, we're at 29%. So we're actually very proud of the fact that we've got a pretty good mixed portfolio in terms of the support and operational funding for the zoo. But it also, I think it's important to note that it's probably not possible to take that 29% down to zero or get anywhere close to that. We are going to rely on a public-private partnership going forward. We think it's at a good basis right now, and we'd certainly like to see it maintained to the level possible, given the challenges we all are facing. Most recently, if you look at what's happened just in the last biennium, we've essentially had our state operating support reduced by about $1 million a year. That actually represents about a 13% cut in state support just over the last year. I apologize. I believe the document that you all have says 9%. Didn't do the math right on that. It's actually about a 13% reduction just in the last biennium. That said, we've been able to not just survive but thrive, given the entrepreneurial spirit at the zoo, the new exhibits, the attendance, and the private fundraising. But obviously, we are concerned that there's a limit to the amount that we're going to be able to shoulder ourselves, and we do look to the state to continue to help support this institution, which we believe is providing great value for the state. The value comes not just in the operational support, but I think a lot of our success is due to the fact that there's been significant capital investment in the zoo over the last several years, some of it through the various bonding bills over the last three biennium, And we believe we've proven to be a very good steward of those capital monies when we receive them. Russia's Grizzly Coast, which I've mentioned, opened in 2008, has been named the best new exhibit in the country the year after it opened by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. It's received international acclaim. We have zoo professionals from around the world coming to visit us to take notes about what it is that makes that exhibit work. And it's also worked for the public. It's now by far our most popular exhibit, really representing what we think is the current cutting edge of zoo design. And that said, we've made a lot of improvements, a lot of changes at the zoo, but we still have some significant issues with the original architecture of the zoo, built in the 70s when aesthetics were not a consideration. And probably more importantly, we have a 1.3 million people a year who are trying to come through these little doors that you see in the image here as the front door to the zoo. And with any piece of infrastructure that's over 30 years old, we do have some infrastructure repair, you know, major repair and betterment challenges. We're addressing that now with a project we're calling the Heart of the Zoo, which is taking that main building at the zoo, our entrance and everything around it, and not tearing it down and starting over, but building on the foundation of what's there already and upgrading it, making it more energy efficient, making it more visitor friendly, and adding more experiences for our guests. And the first phase of that will be is now under construction through a public-private funding program of $20 million that was $15 million from last year's bonding bill and $5 million of private funds. And when we open this summer, we'll have a beautiful new entrance that celebrates nature and gets people in the mood for a zoo experience as opposed to the concrete walkway you go through now. A beautiful expanded education center, the Cargill Environmental Education Center, with four new classrooms, each one keyed to special needs and special focus areas, including one classroom that will actually have a view into a live exhibit of penguins. So a unique venue, an opportunity for learning for all those hundreds of thousands of kids who are coming to the zoo for educational activities. We've taken our old whale pool. Those of you who've been out to the zoo in the last several years may recall back in the early 80s we had beluga whales in a facility that we look at it now and say it was far too small for them. That pool's been sitting empty for 15 years and we came up and didn't hold water, hasn't had any activity, and it was kind of a sore thumb at the zoo. As we looked at it, we came up with a great adaptive reuse and basically enclosed the space and have created what is going to be called the Target Learning Center, an indoor theater for our free flight bird show and for a host of other educational and community activities. So it'll be a great new addition to the zoo, again, reusing something that was already there but was completely underused. And the highlight of the big development that we're engaged in right now is a new exhibit of penguins, African black-footed penguins in a beautiful natural habitat exhibit, views above and below water, taking advantage of the fact that we know that people love penguins, and we've never had them at the zoo, so it's one of those things we know is going to have a lot of box office appeal, yet it's also a great opportunity to talk about a lot of environmental issues, the depletion of fisheries, things like that that are affecting penguins, that are things that we think our visitors need to be aware of as well. This will all be opening up in July of this year, so we're excited to continue the growth of the zoo. And I think if you haven't been out in recent years, I think you'd be quite amazed at the changes and just watching how the public is using this zoo. We're very pleased with the progress that we've been able to make. It couldn't have happened without this public-private partnership, without the support of the legislature, and concurrently the support of the private sector, who are really making our zoo something that we can all be proud of. With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Emke. Can you again just, I know you mentioned it yesterday in Representative Erdahl's committee, how much money have you raised from private donations? I remember in 05 and 06 that you had made some what seemed like pretty hopeful wishes to raise a bunch of money through your private foundation when we had some significant bonding back then. How has that done over the last 5 years compared to what you had hoped for, and what is actually the number in dollars?
Mr. Chair, the Minnesota Zoo Foundation has raised over $24 million since we began our comprehensive campaign in 2006, so I guess that gives you your five-year number. We would like to have raised more for capital projects, but as I mentioned in the hearing yesterday, the foundation is raising money for two things. One, for the operation and ongoing support of existing activities at the zoo, and second, for capital improvements. We have raised all of the money that we projected and more for the operational support of the zoo, and we've raised enough capital money to build all of the projects in combination with the state funding that we've received that we had planned to build during that period. So we think it's been a very successful change in a climate of fundraising. And again, it's because of the lockstep. Instead of the private sector sort of saying, well, it's the state zoo, let's wait for the state to take care of things, which happened in the past, we're seeing fundraising and funding happening on simultaneously. And as a result, the 10 years of or the 10 new exhibits and the new experiences and the attendance numbers that I've mentioned. So we would love to have raised more, but again, we set out some very aggressive goals and we've reached all of the key metrics along the way.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Emke. You know, the it looks like the visitors have dipped during the recession, and that could be expected. This is certainly I would expect. I mean, it's an amenity; it's something that's nice as we look at our budget. Not something that's a must-have or something that's truly needed by Minnesotans, but something that's nice. And so we've seen the kind of the dip in attendance, and if the state legislature, as we look at our budget, behaves the same way, we're going to look at needs above wants or niceties. What have you done to, or what are you looking at in a projection of your budget to look at decreasing your reliance on state resources, both for operating and your bonding projects?
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Actually, our attendance, if you look at the 5 year, the last 5 years, has increased by 40% from where we started in 2005. We saw a slight decline last year and this year as well, but that's from an all-time high of 1.3 million. So I think the overall trend line has been significantly up. To your second question about what are we going to do about basically increasing attendance and hopefully increasing our revenue, the exhibits that I just mentioned, particularly the penguin exhibit, are designed to be attendance draw, you know, something that's going to draw more people to the zoo and more support. And we're anticipating our attendance to continue at the 1.25, 1.3 million a year, which is higher than it's ever been in the history of the zoo. Beyond that, I also mentioned that we have seen a decline in state support just in the past biennium, and we have managed that through cost cutting and through new revenue streams. Looking forward, it's really going to obviously depend on the magnitude of any cuts that we receive. We'll be looking, first and foremost at efficiencies, which we believe we're running a pretty tight ship as it is, but there are, always areas that we probably can defer for some period of time. Secondly, we are looking at other additional ways to generate revenue, whether through the foundation, through private support and contributions, or through new revenue streams at the zoo. So there really will be a combination of cuts to our programs and finding new ways to generate money. And I think that the big thing for us is attendance. That's kind of the key piece. And with that penguin exhibit, we've seen other zoos around the country have opened many types of exhibits. And if there is a trend, penguins work. We're expecting to see a lot more people come next summer as a result.
Thank you.
Representative, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Ms. if I could.
Ms. Adelman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski. The other piece is I.
Could you identify yourself? I don't think you got to do that yet.
Peggy Adelman, Chief Financial Officer at the Minnesota Zoo.
Thank you.
The other piece that I would add is while I agree that the recreation piece falls into the nice, not necessary, discretionary income piece, I think the education programs fall into a different category. We recently had a national person in looking at the emphasis that we all hear about these days on how do you get kids excited about going into science, going into engineering, going into math. And one of the things is you've got the classroom, but they have found that really it's those outside of the classroom experiences that connect kids and get them excited about going into those fields. And we think we do that very well. We've seen with all of the programs, and again, some in public-private partnerships where we are getting private funding to bring kids for field trips, some of the online, some of the distance learning that we plan to go into, that's really where kids can get excited. We work with teachers and look at the state standards, what kids need to learn in the classroom, and all of the educational programs that we put together, we do with that in mind so that we're helping teachers meet those needs. So I think the educational component is a little bit beyond the nice category.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Emke, thank you for being here. I'm curious to know about, I've not been to the zoo. I hope to make it out there sometime this summer. Your admission costs for individuals, families, groups, and so forth, what they are now, what they have been, what you project them to be for the future.
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian. Currently, our adult admission fee is $16, and children are $10. We are looking again at the possibility of an increase in the upcoming summer, given possible cuts at the state level and the new penguin exhibit as a value added. I think one of the things we compare ourselves to are not just other zoos, but because, and you haven't been to our zoo, so you haven't seen it, we have a very significant aquatic component, and aquariums in general, marine mammal facilities and shark exhibits and the like are extremely expensive to operate. And as a result, aquariums tend to have a slightly higher admission fee on average than zoos. And so as a combination zoo and aquarium, we think our fee structure is about where it needs to be given what we have to offer and what the needs are in terms of operating support. We also have a membership program, which I mentioned has grown significantly, which essentially for a family, you can purchase a membership for $105 and have free admission to our zoo and many other zoos around the country for an entire year. And we found that especially people who are planning to visit the zoo more than once quickly do the math and have realized it's a great value and have become members as a result. We also find ways to distribute admission through community action councils and the museum library pass system here in the Twin Cities. So there are numerous ways that people who are in financial need can find ways to get to the zoo for a reduced admission or for free.
Representative Fabian, follow
Thank
up.
You. Yeah, just then for our group, say a busload of kids comes from wherever, you charge them the regular $10 fee per student?
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, we actually have reduced admission fees for school children. Many years ago, it was completely free, but we've had to look at a discounted admission given the rising costs and the reduction in state support over the years. The other thing I did mention in my presentation is the Zoo Safari Program, which is essentially private underwriting of school field trips for numerous communities and school districts around the state. Where a corporation or an individual is essentially paying for the entire cost. The biggest cost, actually, for most of those field trips is transportation, and we found that that is probably more of an impediment to people coming than the admission fee itself.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Emke, you do a great job with the zoo, and it's good to see all the improvements that are occurring there. We have some other zoos in the state, and I'd like to get some idea of how the Minnesota Zoo interacts with Como, Duluth, and then I think there was a Little Falls one, issues with accreditation, and what your role as the Minnesota Zoo is interacting with the other zoos.
Director Emke, and maybe along those lines, if you could talk about how there's a fund of money that's shared among those zoos. I believe, doesn't it come from one of the funds? Specifically, that's got an earmark for zoos.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I'll try to answer both of those questions. There, under the lottery in lieu program, there is a stream of funding that goes to three of the zoos in the state. The original concept was each of the accredited zoos would receive a third of that, which I believe is about $120,000 a year out of the total operation. There are now only two accredited zoos in the state, the Como Zoo in St. Paul and our zoo. A couple of years ago, the Lake Superior Zoo in Duluth lost its accreditation. We've been working very much in hand with the management, the new management at Lake Superior Zoo, to essentially mentor them and provide assistance in their effort to become reaccredited, which we think is really a critical thing. We work closely with Como Zoo on species survival plans and on kind of sharing best practices. Our educators and our animal staff work together on an informal basis all the time. Zoos cannot operate as individual islands. Essentially, animals that are in zoos these days come from other zoos. And so we work together collectively on managing our animal collections. And people who are new to our business, when they come to our industry association meetings, say they do not know of an industry that is more open, transparent, and sharing of information and our resources, because we really do all need to work together. So we've had strong partnerships with the two, Lake Superior and with Como Zoo, support the work they do. Would believe that they would say essentially the same things that we've been saying about what the mission of their zoos are. Obviously, the scale and the types of programs are different, but we've worked closely together with them, and we want them to succeed as well, because it's all part of a bigger goal of zoos, which is the conservation of nature and the education of our kids.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Director Emke. I was out there a couple of weeks when you had the legislators out. I'm really disappointed it was too cold to bring, like, the chinchilla in for everybody to feel. But just a couple of questions. One, how many employees do you have, and are those full-time year-round? And approximately how many animals do you have?
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott. We have about 220 full-time equivalents at the zoo. Obviously, we have a seasonal situation where in the summertime we add significant staff on our guest services and animal care area, but it's about 220 total people. In addition to that, the staff of the Minnesota Zoo Foundation, who raised the private money, there are 10 employees there, and we contract out services. Both our food and retail services are contracted out to vendors who have additional staff who are on grounds. Animals, we have about 4,000 individual animals representing 510 species, so a pretty significant collection. A lot of them are, as I mentioned earlier, we're a combination zoo and aquarium, so a large number of those, the species count, are fish, but we have a pretty varied collection. And interestingly, as you probably noticed when you came to the zoo, we try to show animals in their natural social group, so rather than having two of a lot of different types of animals, we often have herds or flocks or large kind of natural associations of animals in bigger exhibits than the traditional zoo.
One more follow-up to that. Director Emke, how many volunteer hours, full-time equivalents, do you have? When I go to the zoo, oftentimes it seems like there's more people that have labels on them that they're volunteers than employees. What's the current situation in that?
Mr. Chair, we have a fantastic volunteer corps. It's about 800 adults who've gone through a pretty rigorous training and have devoted and committed to a certain number of days a month to come out to the zoo. We've estimated that the value of their time at the zoo is well over $1 million a year in, you know, personal services that we could not otherwise be offering to our guests. They really are, in many ways, as you mentioned, the front line and the individuals that most of our guests encounter when they come to the zoo, so they're a really important part of our operation.
Thank you. Director Emke, I've got one more question. In regards to the moose that are at the zoo, how many moose are there, and do you coordinate with the university or the DNR in any studying of them? We are losing our population of moose in northern Minnesota. because of, we're not sure why, but many people point to maybe as climate change. But what problems have you found in southern Minnesota with your moose there, and how are they doing?
Mr. Chair, our moose at the zoo, who have become southern Minnesota moose, I guess, by virtue of coming down here, are doing well. I believe we have four in the collection right now. We had a pair of moose twins were born about 3 years ago, and they're growing up now. So our exhibit of moose is successful. It's one of they're actually a fairly difficult animal to maintain in captivity, so not many zoos have them, but we've got a long, good record of breeding and maintaining them. But your second question, and probably the bigger one that we're all concerned about, is the fate of the moose in the wild. And our veterinary staff and biologists in the biological programs area are working hand in hand with the DNR and the university on exactly the program that you mentioned, the research up in northern Minnesota to get a handle on what's happening to that population up there. We bring the expertise of vets who are used to dealing with large animals, needing to tranquilize, radio collar, and remobilize animals is something that we're offering essentially as part of that program. We're very interested in helping out where we can, and this is a natural one with one of the great iconic animals of Minnesota, and we need to know more in order to figure out what we can do to save them.
As a side note, Director, how much did the bull moose's antlers raise in auction last year? I know that's one of your more popular items. They auction off the antlers. If I'm not mistaken, he's getting to have a pretty healthy set of antlers each year now.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we love the fact that it's a renewable resource. and I can't remember the exact number, but there was some pretty lively bidding, and it was well over $1,000 that added to a total of over $350,000 that we raised at our fundraiser last year.
And the date of that, again, this coming April, is when?
April 30th, and you will all receive invitations. We'd love to have you see how this public-private partnership is working.
The Beastly Ball, if I remember correctly. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Amke, one last question, two-part. First of all, I was always curious which other state also owns a zoo. I know there's two. You mentioned that. And also, you've got 220 employees. I'm curious about kind of the constraints or patterns around employing those as a public institution. I assume they're probably unionized employees. Compensation costs probably run higher than they do with those privately owned zoos in the other 48 states. I'm curious if you could comment on that and if that provides you greater economic pressure to your operating costs than, say, maybe those other states.
Director Amke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski. I'm sorry, your first question again was?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Which other state?
Thank you. The other state zoo is the North Carolina Zoo, which, interestingly, was also established in the 70s. There's an interesting story about the selection of the site for where the Minnesota Zoo should be located. There was competition by a number of communities around the metro for where the zoo should be located, and ended up Apple Valley, which we think was probably the right decision given how population has grown around the zoo. But in North Carolina, they decided to go for the geographic center of the state, which to some might be considered the middle of nowhere. And so they've had a much rougher time in terms of attendance just because they're not close to a major metropolitan area. It is a beautiful zoo, but I think they have a significantly higher level of reliance on their state for operating support than we do here. We are, as a state agency, the majority of our employees are in one of the various union, state employee unions. I think, we look nationally at salary levels at zoos. We do a survey as part of the AZA. And I think it's similar to other institutions where perhaps in some of the, I guess you could call them lower level positions, the salary levels are a bit higher than they might be in the private sector. But in the middle management and management area, we are in fact considerably lower than comparable major zoos around the country. That said, that's something flexibility and the ability to be more nimble is something we'd certainly welcome if that's part of a solution this year.
Thank you. Representative Fall.
you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Emke, to that point, I'd also ask, do a majority of your employees have some form of either bachelor's degree or further schooling to characterize or classify them to be able to work in a zoo environment or to be able to work in kind of the scientific environment?
Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say that actually it's a prerequisite for any of our animal care physicians that at least a college degree, at least a bachelor's degree in biology or a related field is part of a requirement. The zoo, however, if you look at our total employee base, we're essentially like a small city. We have a full contingent of various shops. We have grounds crews. We have maintenance folks. So those in some of those positions, higher education, higher degrees are not necessarily critical, but certainly in the professional level, animal care and science positions at the zoo, we have almost all of our employees have college degrees or advanced degrees.
Representative Paul, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Emke, thank you for that. I do appreciate the clarification and want to commend all those people too, because I imagine that they have very, very high levels of skills in particular areas, and they could find work in many different areas, but their commitment to making sure that the zoo functions is, you know, once again, a commitment they make to public service and to making all of our lives better. So thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Representative Knute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is more of a personal curiosity thing about the penguin exhibit. Is it, because I know, are these the ones on the South African coast, I'm assuming? And could you describe any of the conservation efforts that your exhibit will be a part of, or if it'll be a part of any of the efforts with the African penguin?
Sure. Director Emke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth. Yes, the penguins that will be featured at our zoo are black-footed African, or as they used to be called, jackass penguins. The name comes from the fact that they make a braying call that's remarkably like a donkey. They are becoming increasingly endangered in the wild. They've, in the last 10 years, their population has declined by as much as 90% through a combination of factors. There have been some significant oil spills that impacted them. But probably the biggest issue is overfishing in the region that the animals are part of. And so our role in conservation is really twofold. One is, and this is true of just about all of our exhibits, one is making the public aware of the fact that these animals exist, that they live in Africa, which people don't think of penguins possibly living that far north, and the challenges that are confronting them, including things that we can do here through more thoughtful consumption of seafood. And we have a sustainable seafood program that will be linked directly to the exhibit. So there's the whole public education component. But secondarily, these animals are part of a species survival plan in North American zoos. They're managed as all the black-footed penguins in all of the North American zoos are managed as a single population to increase genetic diversity and maintain a healthy population in zoos. And we are now a participant in that species survival plan. Our penguins are coming, 16 of them are coming from Baltimore, and 4 of them are coming from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. So we expect they'll get along. They may have cultural differences for a while, but that's part of the activity that we do with many of our species in zoos, which is, again, the cooperative management and breeding programs. We will also, as the foundation, which supports conservation efforts outside of the zoo itself, we've actually provided funding and have had some of our staff travel on their own time to South Africa to be involved in research and banding and kind of a population census of the animals there. So three ways really that we're connecting the exhibit to the conservation of the animals in nature.
Thank you, Director Emke and Ms. Edelman. We appreciate you coming in this morning. Next we're going to hear from Len Price, who's the Executive Director of Conservation Corps. I think they've dropped the Minnesota, if I'm not mistaken, but Mr. Price, if you want to come forward. For those of you that don't know, Mr. Price is a former state senator from out on the east side of the metro, like myself. Welcome, Mr. Price, and give us a lowdown on the Conservation Corps, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Len Price. I'm the executive director of Conservation Corps Minnesota and Iowa. The name change resulted as a result of our applying to the AmeriCorps program for a national direct grant. And in that process, you have to be engaged in activities in two states. And so we partnered up with Iowa. And it's kind of hard to go to Iowa and say, "Hi, I'm Len Price. I'm with Conservation Corps Minnesota." And they look at you sort of funny and say, "Well, how come you don't have Iowa in your name?" So that's one of the reasons that we did that. Plus the marketing aspect of it. So Minnesota Conservation Corps, which was held so dearly by so many people over the years, MCC, is still used as our name by a lot of people, but we are officially Conservation Corps Minnesota and Iowa. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. We forwarded to the committee administrator some materials for your use prior to the hearing. One was our annual report to the legislative committees about the expenditure of our state funds that we get, and we'll talk a little bit about that this morning. Also, our recruiting pamphlet that we use, which has a general summary of the programs that we have. And I think in my meeting with almost every one of the committee members so far, I've provided you with a 2009 annual report. I have extra copies. If anybody wishes them, we can have the pages distribute them. I do not have any extra copies of the legislative report. I'd like to, I think I have about 10 minutes here is what I was told. The chairman wanted five, but being a good neighbor, he allowed me an extra five. So I'd just like to have you think about a couple of things. I've been monitoring your committee, and I've heard some of these same questions here by committee members. One is, you know, we ought to get more young people involved in their community. I think it was Representative Quam one day said, how do we get young people engaged in thinking about the environment and their community? Other people have said, you know, if all of us would pull together, we could make things a lot better. Other people have noted, we need to unplug young people, in fact, all age people, from all these electronic things that they engage with and get them outside, back into nature. And other people said, there's certainly a lot of work to do here on our parks, on the amenities that we have with our natural resources. How are we going to take care of them without it costing us so much? And other people have said, we've forgotten how to get our hands dirty. We ought to have some activities for all range people of all ages to go outdoors and do some natural resource work, some hands-on work. And then there have been other times, usually after a storm or a flood, when they've said, this is such a mess. How in the world are we going to clean this up? Who can we go to get some help? And then finally, I've heard a lot of people say, we need to give young people some job and work experience. These are age-old questions. They aren't just unique to this time. And I'm not here today to say that the Conservation Corps is the ultimate answer to these questions, but I'd like to propose the proposition that we address many of those questions, and I'd like to explain a little bit more about how that happens. Let's go back to the 1930s, probably the worst economic time that we've had. There were a lot of people unemployed, in fact, probably around 30%, 9% today, quite a drastic difference. But among young people, during the Depression, there seemed to be no hope. And so one of the programs in the Alphabet Soup administrative programs in the Roosevelt administration was the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. I think that resonates with people. They kind of understand that they planted a lot of trees and did a lot of conservation-type activities. We have a member of our board who was in the CCC. He went in at age 16. And I've appeared on several panels with him to talk to young people about our program. And Monty always says, you know what the CCC gave us besides the dollar a day wages? It gave us hope. It gave us a chance to get some technical skills. It gave us three square meals a day. Well, we're not in that desperate situation today, but we do provide a lot of those same things to the young people whose lives we engage. We do provide them with technical skills. We do give them a transition period. We do give them a chance to network and be engaged with mentors and people that they might work for in the future. There's been other conservation movements in the country in more contemporary times. In the 1970s and 80s, there was actually a national conservation program. The funding ended in about 1981 when there were several cutbacks in federal programming, and it was at that time each state had to decide should it have a conservation program be continued. And the decision was made in Minnesota, yes, and we'll put it inside the Department of Natural Resources. We'll call it the Minnesota Conservation Corps. So that's where we were as a program until 2003. Governor Ventura was proposing his budget, and he cut the funding for the program in the DNR. And the DNR said, you know, we're managers of natural resources. We're not managers of human resources. We're not a youth development, young adult development agency. So the arrangement was made, and I was part of that decision-making process, to have the Conservation Corps become a 501c3 nonprofit. And there was some funding given to bridge the transition from being part of DNR to being this new nonprofit organization. So since 2003, Conservation Corps Minnesota has operated as a 501c3, and it's done very well. It's done very well because of support from the legislature, collaborations with outside other nonprofits and other governmental units, and because of the work of the staff and the board of directors. We have in the audience today our chair, John Valine, who used to work around these halls as executive director of the now LCCMR, Legislative and Citizens Commission on Natural Resources, and Cindy Green, who is our development director, is in the back row, responsible for the production of a lot of these pieces of information that we pass on to you. Those are the type of folks that are believers in this organization and what we do, and they're the ones that help make it work. I'm oftentimes just a facilitator and a mouthpiece because I believe passionately in the mission of our organization. We take young people and give them an opportunity to restore resources and change their lives. This brochure outlines the various programs that we have. There are programs for high school youngsters 15 through 18, and then there's a whole set of programs for young adults 18 through 25. We're connected with the AmeriCorps program, so there's an opportunity for young people, young adults, to earn what's called an education award to help them go back to school or pay off their past expenses. We can talk about that if you wish or if you have questions. We engage these folks all over the state of Minnesota. A lot of work is done in Representative Dill's district by our youth program because he has most of the state parks along the North Shore. We'll provide at a later date what we call a SAW report to you, a survey of accomplished work. And it will delineate the hours and things that we've done in your particular district. And every year when I used to pass them out in the committee, Representative Dill would have the biggest, longest list because he's got so much public land in his district. Because that's where we do our work, is primarily on public land in association with public entities. We will work on private land if indeed the homeowner or the owner is involved in a publicly financed program. So our mission is to give these young people this hands-on experience. They learn a great deal of things about the environment and natural resource management. We are in that report illustrating what happens to the money that you invest in us. We get a small sum of general fund dollars, $455,000 a year. It was much bigger than that when we left the DNR in 2003, but it's decreased. We also received directly from the state $490,000 in natural resource dedicated fund. You buy a boat license, part of that goes for water access. You buy a snowmobile license, part of that goes for snowmobile trails. There's all these fees that are by statute specifically dedicated to specific work, and we have a collaborative with the department, and we do that work specifically. We call that restricted funding because it must be done on those particular types of activities. Since we become a nonprofit, we've been able to go out and ask foundations for contributions. We do a lot of what we call fee-for-service work. Our crews have a set rate of fee for each hour that they work. We are asked by several different partners to do the work. 52%, I believe, is what the report tells you is how much we spent last year or collected last year of our revenue from fee-for-service. I think on the chart it's called partner support. We get money from the AmeriCorps program, and by virtue of that, we've been in a position to leverage federal dollars. For example, we're in the third year of a four-year federal stimulus expenditure in Superior National Forest, where 30 young people have been doing trail maintenance work each summer. There will be another additional 10 people, or 40 total, this summer as they go in for 6 days, do trail maintenance, live in tents, work very hard, come back out for 6 days, go back in. There'll be some opportunities for maybe some of your constituents to actively apply and be involved in that program. We have lots of other programs too, but we don't have a lot of time right now to explain that. I asked some of the young people who were engaged last year in our program when we had the end of the year and concluding activities to tell me what they would ask me to tell you about our program, because they can't be here. They're either back in school, or today there's 150 of them up in Camp Friendship at Annandale's second day of their training for this year's activities. One young man who worked in Brainerd last year wrote this: why support the Conservation Corps? It promotes a passion for community and national service. It helps preserve and restore our great natural resources. It puts young people to work and keeps money flowing in the local region economy. And it teaches members valuable technical and life skills, benefiting the community as a whole. Here's one other young man who wrote, I have earned money to go back to college, learned about my career opportunities, served my community, and developed a heck of a work ethic in my community. Another person wrote that when the trucks show up at the job site, it's really important for all of us to work and look like we're not just another crew from some other place. He said we learn how to work our butts off. That's a quote. He misspelled butts, though. And another person who articulated several of them, but I thought this one was really pretty interesting. Perhaps the best experience I had was when I had the chance to interact with the people of the communities we were working in, whether it be on a trail, in a state park, at a WMA, or in a city park. The response was always positive, and sometimes we ended up with baked goods. Spoken like a true teenager. So finally, I would just say that when you go back to think about those questions, do we as an organization address those things? Yes, we do provide lots of technical skills, job skills. All of our young adults are certified chainsaw operators. They're wildfire fighters certified. We do have a special relationship with the DNR to respond to wildfires. They're all wilderness first aid trained. And depending on where they're working in the state with the particular ecosystem that they're involved in, they get specific training to do the tasks within that arena. Do we have a cost-effective labor force here? Yes, they're all working for very little because they believe in community service. And so people can tap into us, and we're willing to do this work for relatively a small amount of money. That's not intended to be competitive with the private sector. It's intended to illustrate, again, the commitment to learning about community and national service. I think I'll stop with that, Mr. Chairman, and see if there's questions.
Thank you, Director. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, Mr. Price, how do you work with other youth groups in the state, like possibly the Boy Scouts or the 4-H, or do you work with them? Or
Director Price.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Scott, we really don't have any formal relationship with those other organizations. We know that some of the participants have been in those organizations that come into our program. High school youngsters are in the program for 8 weeks in the summer. An ideal crew would be two metro kids, two outstate kids, two inner city kids, and if you could have two deaf or hard of hearing youngsters in that crew of six, that would be ideal. they could come from any background, any place. I can tell you many, many stories about the chemistry and the changes that have occurred because those young people are together. But their experiences are pretty varied. We don't have a formal outreach with those organizations.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Price, for your testimony. I don't really have a question. I just, for the benefit of the new members on this committee, having served on here for this would be my ninth year on this committee, I've heard most of all of these different projects. But I want to tell you about my experience. As Senator Price said, a lot of work is done in my area because we have millions upon millions of acres of public land. We know that their work is good. We know that the cost is very, very reasonable. We know that our investment into the CCC, whether it's been a Republican chairman or a DFL chairman of this committee, we've always invested in this program because we know that our return on investment to the to our shareholders, which are our constituents, is very, very high because of the leverage against federal money, leverage against the dedicated accounts that they are able to use to work on the different types of trails, boat accesses, snowmobile trails, all forest access roads, all of those things. But the one thing that I really want to pass on to you is that, you know, I travel in my district and I have lots of state parks, and their folks, the CCC folks, are very highly identifiable because of their dress, the way they dress. I see them in restaurants, I see them at gas stations, I see them along the road in ditches, and I try to stop as often as I can to say hello, because they don't know me from Adam. They think I'm some UFO, and I tell them I'm a state representative. They go, oh my God, it's the government. You know, but I can tell you that there's one thread that I want to share with you. I think that a lot of these kids are in need of guidance, are in need of some help getting their life together, and this program does that. It's another benefit. It's another return on the overall investment. But the one thing I can tell you that I have never, in 9 years as being a state representative, I have never run across, whether it's in a restaurant, on the street, in a ditch, in a state park, on a snowmobile trail, I have never run across an unhappy crew. They're always happy. And they live in tents. They get eaten up by mosquitoes. They got ticks on them. I'm sure that they like to do tick checks at some time during the day, at night. And so, I mean, that's not a fun thing. And so we really get, not to say that in other programs we don't get a lot, but in this one, the investors into this program, our shareholders, our taxpayers, really get the bang for the buck. Now, that being said, I know things are going to be very difficult in the coming times, and I recognize that. But I want you to think about that, is that not one time in 9 years have anyone grumbled at me on any of those crews. And I'm talking dozens upon dozens of crews that I visited with, whether restaurant in Silver Bay, Grand Marais, you name it, or International Falls. And just go out and try and plant trees in the middle of July. That's not easy. So that's what I had to say about that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Well said. It's a good program. And Director Price, thanks for being here today. And we appreciate finding ways to accommodate. And Director Price, the one comment I would want to make is thank you for concentrating on helping these kids out and walking the fine line between getting too far over to where you really compete with the private sector and the things they do, and you've done a great job of realizing your role. And we want to give kids encouragement to, it's not all bad wanting to plant trees or do whatever you want to do, but to get outdoors and realize, get away from your iPod and cell phone, and especially when some of them are down and out and maybe need a little help and a little guidance, putting them in a tent with mosquitoes and rain and all that, all of a sudden they appreciate what they have a little more. So thank you, and what a great avocation for you to get involved in, and we look forward to working with you and being creative as we go through the challenges faced us going ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Dill, thanks for the great testimony. That's very nice. You've always said they always are happy, and we're happy they're happy.
And we're glad you're happy. With that, Representative Hackbart, next we're going to hear Folks, we're going to just hear a couple of bills for informational only, kind of informally. We've got some time today. We're going to do a couple. They probably aren't going to take the whole time, so we could easily get done early. And then tomorrow, I think we're going to have a few more controversial ones. These are all in preparation for Representative Hackbart's going to put together what commonly referred to as the Game and Fish Bill. It'll be a number of bills brought together that deal with game and fish issues that historically were heard in Representative Dill's division of the Environment Committee. Now they fall under our wide-ranging jurisdiction of environment, energy, and natural resources. Representative Hackbart, House File 348.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, as Chairman McNamara said, he asked me to carry the Game and Fish Bill this year, and we'll be putting together a number of different bills that you've submitted, and we'll put it together in one package. We're going to hear the bills individually, and we'll just take testimony. We'll be laying them over for possible inclusion, and we're going to start with a couple today, and we'll start with House File 348, which is my bill, and today I have Mr. Jeff Weaver with me, and this is really his issue, and I am bringing this forward for him, and I will let Mr. Weaver explain the bill and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Chairman McNamara, Jeff Weaver, Anoka. What House File 348 really does is deal with equity in the waterfowl world, and those that are avid waterfowlers know that part of the fabric of being a waterfowler is getting up in the wee hours of the morning and heading to your slough or your lake or your blind, checking out the wind directions and setting your decoys and trying to fool a duck to come into range. Well, what happens with the way the language is on the books today, it allows a person who has property on public water, and that's kind of the key word here, is public water, water that's open to the public, to leave decoys out in waters that are joining their private property. And what that really does is, in my estimation, and we see it firsthand where we waterfowl hunt, is that it usurps people's right and the ability to come onto that public water and compete with them. You have folks that are leaving out in situations that we see couple hundred decoys, and they're leaving them out year-round, and they never come in, and they leave the posts out in the water, in public waters, that they attach their spinning wing decoys to when they become legal. And in most situations, you have a father and a son, or a father and daughter that come down to a public access and go out in the lake, and they fill their boat with their two or three dozen decoys, and they go out to the weed patch to set up. Well, in a waterfowling situation, you don't compete with somebody that's got 200 or 300 decoys out, and it just doesn't work. And what Representative Hackbart's bill does is really make some equality in the overall game of waterfowl hunting. And really, in today's world of waterfowl hunting, where Minnesota has been challenged lately with the flyways, the amount of birds that are in the state, we're really talking about fair chase. We're talking about hunter retention and hunter recruitment.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Weaver? Mr. Weaver, I think I'm going to ask Mr. Bogus maybe, or unless Representative Hackbart maybe. If I'm not mistaken, the definition for public waters could include water that's entirely surrounded by private property. And if I'm not mistaken, this would somewhere where would stop somebody currently being able to put out decoys on their own pond that's surrounded by all their own property, not be able to leave the decoys out in that water overnight. I'm just wondering if you could address that, and maybe Director, if you could come down after we give Mr. Weaver or Representative Hackbart a chance.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and we can bring Mr. Bogus down, that's fine. I think we talked about this a little bit last year, and I think we had a provision that changed that so we could eliminate that particular problem. And we're willing to work with that and do that again.
Mr. Weaver.
Chairman McNamara, I think that provision was, there was a sentence in the bill that talked about if the public water had a public access.
Well, thank you, Representative Hackbart. I thought you were actually repealing that. This never happened. I keep forgetting that we had this problem with walleyes and two lines and Fish Lake, and things didn't happen. So, right. Director Bogus, we won't need you to come down. Thank you. More questions? Representative Quam.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Weaver, yes. My concern is that this could impact people that for generations have been hunting, and that they've had that private land, they've been hunting that area, and, you know, I don't want to impinge upon private rights, even though the government has designated, and as was pointed out by the chair, some of these public waters are, you know, basically private, or should have been private, and so I really would like to see something better protecting, you know, the private land owners' area, because I've got issues with not infringing on that. There ought to be some advantage, because you upkeep the beach. You've got an investment there where somebody that, is accessing that, that doesn't own any land around that public water, doesn't have that investment in there. And, can you let me know what kind of protections you wish to add in? Because this seems to be just wiping it out and not allowing, additional protections.
I really don't think, Representative,
Weaver.
Thank you. I don't think it wipes out the private property rights at all. We have that same situation. We own private property. We come down every morning and set out our decoys, and we pick them up at the end of the day. But when you have a neighbor that has 200 or 300 decoys out, in another scenario, you could have somebody who has a cabin on a lake on a 50-foot lot, and they could have 1,000 decoys out in front of their cabin. And it's, so you run into all types of different scenarios. When you have a public access on a public piece of water, the public has a right to come out and to go and hunt on a public piece of water in some bulrushes or in a place that will conceal them. And what it's doing with the way the law is, it's really usurping that ability for a person to come onto public waters, not private waters, but public waters that are owned by those taxpayers that live in the state of Minnesota and bought a license to go duck hunting.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative Quam.
Then why don't you address that thousands of decoys? Because I've got many people in my district that love hunting.
Sure.
Some of those have had hip replacements. Some of those are getting on in years. And, going out in the middle in the cold and et cetera, I think if they set it up, if you limit to where X amount of time before season and after, I just think that all or nothing is not something that I could vote and support.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, just curious, the scenario that you mentioned where people leave them out beyond the season for the whole year, how is that impacted by this? Or I wouldn't think we'd want to have them keeping them on public waters through the winter.
Well, they don't keep them through the winter. They keep them...
Mr. Weaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, they're leaving them out during the entire season. So they put them out at the beginning of the year. They have a very large weight, and they have a string line, and they'll leave those decoys out year-round. They'll leave the posts and placements out for spinning wing decoys, and it's a pretty neat deal to come down with a hot cup of coffee at shooting hours, and really you take away a piece of the fabric of the waterfowl world. That's part of the game. That's part of the allure of going duck hunting. It's tough. It's not. Duck hunting isn't supposed to be an easy sport. It's a tough sport, and it's what made some of the famous paintings that you see by Cuba. And it's just what it's all about.
Mr. Weaver, could you lay out so we can, so I think a number of the folks on the committee here, I alluded to a situation where you could actually have a pond within your private property that would be considered public waters, where this, if this was constructed wrong, this bill, you wouldn't be able to leave decoys out where nobody else has access. I believe what you're trying to address here is public waters that have legal access for a number of different people, where people under current law have the ability to leave decoys out in an area that the general public or maybe multiple private landowners have access to the water, where that's the issue here. And for the members, we have in law, public waters are different than land. The waters of the state of Minnesota are owned by the public. And if you have access, if you take sloughs and streams, if you have a slough that you can, for instance, float a canoe into a slough, and you can get in, say, upstream in a slough and float down that slough into the water, that water could be entirely encircled by private property. But you have the absolute right to go on that public water and hunt that land, hunt that water, as long as you have legal cover. So there's a number of issues here involved that we have to be real careful of. And I think what Mr. Weaver, if you could allude to a situation and a hypothetical one of where somebody might do what you're talking about, and under current law it's legal for them to do, and if you could just real quickly just lay it out for us to envision in our minds, and then we do have additional question from Representative Dill when you're done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For instance, and the scenario that you alluded to is exactly correct. You don't want to take away the ability for somebody to do that as private land all the way around a piece of water. It's in a scenario where you'd have a public access and private property by that public access. People are leaving, and what we're seeing is hundreds of decoys out season long, and what happens is it takes away the ability for a person to come down in their boat with their son or their daughter and set up a spread of decoys out in the reeds, maybe 200-400 yards away from where these private properties are. You just cannot compete with when people leave that many decoys out. You physically cannot, in a morning's time when you're setting out blocks, have the time to compete with if somebody's left those decoys out.
Thank you. Anything else, Representative Hackmark? Okay. Representative Dill.
Well, thank you. And again, I don't have a question. I just want the new members of the committee. I always feel after 9 years of debating this issue that the new members of the committee have to know that this is a complicated issue, and that regardless of how the bill falls out, and I certainly have sympathy for the situation that's been illustrated, you're going to have people that aren't happy on this thing and that are passionate waterfowlers, whether it be young people, old people, middle-of-the-road people, wealthy people, poor people. It means no difference. You know, it's just a complicated, complicated issue. And public water is, in my view, public water. And people have the right to put out one decoy or 1,000 decoys. And so the question is, in my mind, is can we allow people to have decoys on public water indefinitely or during the entire season? Regardless of what gets me is that what if the next step is that we say someone wants to put a 48-foot Bertram on a piece of public water and anchor it out there. And that takes up more space on the water than a 16-foot Lund who wants to anchor in a similar place. I mean, when are we going to, you know, where are we going to stop? Where are we going to start? Where are we going to stop with all of this? And what implications does it have for the other things? It's complicated, so make sure that you know the issue before you make your... I'm not trying to persuade you one way or the other, but this is complicated, and we've wrestled with this for 9 years that I am aware of.
Well, Representative Dill, for, as you said, the majority of folks on the committee probably isn't as passionate it is for, like, you and I who spend lots and lots of hours waterfowl hunting, and it's like, are you serious? We're dealing with a $6 billion deficit, and you're talking about... But, folks, if this is your passion, which it is for many of us, our hair gets raised up in a hurry all of a sudden, and how the implications fit. What I would say is we deal with these game and fish issues members, you're going to have constituents that this is really of an interest to them. Make sure that you work with the author of the individual bills and understand how it applies to your constituents' issue, and work with Director Bogus and the other folks in the DNR. And sometimes you're going to have an opinion that's going to be different than others of us. Please let us know that, whether it's two-line fishing or decoy. I mean, this is literally getting in the weeds in this one. And I will tell you, I've got constituents that are big-time waterfowl hunters on the river, and this is a huge, huge issue. I got a group down in Spring Lake that camp and keep this spot the whole season by rotating how they sit out on the islands and stuff. And it's, I mean, it's legal. What they're doing is legal, but it's not fair. You know, so there's a lot of, I mean, it's hard for you to, if you're not a duck hunter, you get all of a sudden, and, you know, it's a big issue. Thank you, Mr. Weaver, and we look forward to finding resolution in a tough issue for sure. Next, I believe we have Representative Dill. You've got a deer kill by motor vehicle permitted to be kept by the driver. Representative Dill, I'm also wondering, you say deer. How would it affect an elk or a moose? Is it going to... Or a bear. Thank you.
We'll let the Officer Smith answer that question. Members, this was in the game and fish bill that was vetoed last year because of the fish lake provision, Mr. Chairman. I don't think there were any other controversial issues in that bill.
It was two-line fishing, Representative Dill.
I didn't think that was controversial. It works real good.
Welcome to the legislature. Guess
thank
again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank
so
you.
This is about possession of a deer if you hit it legally with a motor vehicle. Now, that sounds kind of funny, you hit it legally. That means that you didn't do it illegally, that you purposely didn't hit the deer, because these horns and heads are, you know, getting massively valuable. And this is another for the new members. It just keeps recurring to me of what I know today and what I used to know 9 years ago, and they're two different things. These horns are just becoming a massive value monetarily. And so, I mean, people actually might take a $2,000 hit on their car to get a $10,000 set of horns. I mean, you can see the numbers work. But this bill came because of a couple of different actions that happened out across the state. And it wasn't controversial. I think the department is okay, is fine with it. And I brought Conservation Officer Smith down here, Captain?
Major.
Major. Oh, Major. All right. Major Smith down to kind of give you a quick rundown of the history of how we got to where we're at today.
Major.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Major Rodman Smith, DNR Operations Manager for the Division of Enforcement. Just to, if I may, just scope this issue a little bit for you. Industry insurance estimates that there's probably about 30,000 car deer collisions a year in the state of Minnesota. The numbers vary a little bit from insurance company to insurance company. Last year, there was about 15,000 car deer permits issued by law enforcement to people that hit a deer and then wanted to take that deer into their possession. So it is a rather large amount of deer that are being hit by cars, and then about half of those deer are actually being salvaged, because I'm sure everybody drives down the road and sees dead deer laying on the side of the road that haven't been able to be salvaged. So we're talking a rather large amount. The people that issue these permits are law enforcement officers, and the vast majority of the permits are issued by state troopers, county sheriff's departments, police departments, and believe it or not, conservation officers. We probably issue the fewest of all the law enforcement agencies, just for the mere fact that they normally do involve a collision, so there is going to be some type of accident report written, so a trooper or a deputy or a police officer is going to be on scene. They'll be writing the crash report. They do work 24/7. Our officers, you know, there's There's only a few number of us around the state, and we're not working 24/7. I mean, we do work various hours, but we can't have one officer working 24/7, 7 days a week. So the locals do issue a lot of these permits. So what this would do would clarify that the driver of a motor vehicle that has collided with a deer basically has first right of refusal to that deer if the facts at the scene show that the deer wasn't taken or hit illegally. So it basically gives the person that's driving the car first right of refusal on whether or not they want to have that deer. There are several counties that do have car kill deer lists where the dispatcher has a list of folks that say, put me on the list for a car kill deer if you get one, because there are people that hit deer that say, we don't want that stinky thing, you know, so then they'll call somebody and somebody else will come out and then get that deer. Then they're given a possession permit. Really what the possession permit is it allows that person then to process that deer, possess that deer. They can bring it to a meat lock or whatever they want to do, and then it would be almost like they took it under a license, firearms license or an archery license. They can do whatever they want with that deer. So, and if you want me to address bear, moose, elk, or anything like that at this time, Mr. Chairman?
Please, Major.
Okay. As I said, we had about 15,000, roughly, permits a year for deer. The elk, moose, bear, very, very few of those actually get hit by cars. And those are usually when a state trooper, a deputy will call a conservation officer. For bear, for example, we do give out possession permits, but we do sell those to people at a very, very, very low monetary rate, maybe $50. Moose we will sell to people too, and that's very, very low rate. It's usually around $50. And then I don't know if we've had too many elk car collisions, but if we did, it would be basically the same thing where a person would, you know, get a possession permit, and we'd probably sell it to them for, you know, a very nominal dollar amount.
Major Smith, my question centers around, for instance, the trophy elk that I believe the gentleman that found it in northwestern Minnesota is going to end up with possession of those antlers. But so are you telling me that if that would have been hit by his car instead of him finding it and the situation there, I believe in the end he's going to get those antlers because he found it. But if he would have hit that by a car, would that not have been the possession of the person that hit it? You'd have been free, because if I'm not mistaken, those antlers are worth in six figures. Representative Dill talked about them being very valuable. I think I've heard this elk's antlers could be worth $100,000. So what would happen if that elk would have been hit by a car instead of be found by this individual?
Mr. Chair, you're correct that those antlers are, well, he's, from what we hear, he's been offered the money, and it is six figures, and that wasn't hit by a car. It was had some other trauma and ended up being put down by a conservation officer. There wasn't any indication that there was any ill will or chicanery, I guess you could say, around that, those circumstances. So the officer did issue that person a possession permit to possess that elk. If that elk was hit by a car, once again, the way we've been operating, you know, if there's nothing at the scene that would indicate that that elk would have been purposely run down or maybe shot and then hit by a car to make it look like there was some type of damage, more than likely they probably would have gotten that elk the exact same way, so there wouldn't have been any difference. So,
well, Major, I appreciate that, but the more than likely and absolute are two different things. So I hope Representative Dale, who's never been afraid to work on difficult issues with the DNR, may address that issue too, because I think that's where we really have the potential to look like the bad guys in this if we end up taking a elk or a deer. And I mean, there can be trophy deer antlers that can be worth, as Representative Dill has already said. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dill, checking to see if you've met or talked with anybody in the car insurance industry on this. I know I've been contacted a number of times by insurance dealers in my district about deer auto collisions and just what any potential impact, not to have a pun, but any effect that your bill might have relating to the insurance industry.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen. I haven't been contacted by anyone on this. It's been suggested that if it's been suggested not by the insurance companies but by constituents that if they buy a deer license, whether they hunt or not, if they buy a deer license before the first day of season, that if they hit a deer any time during the year, that the state pay out of the Game and Fish Fund for their deductible for their insurance. You know, because we've got so many deer, and, you know, we're marketing deer. I mean, some people think like that, but that comes from the private side, not the insurance side.
Representative Hansen, follow up.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Dillard would be happy to share some contacts with you on this if you'd like.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Major, I'm glad you shared with us the number of 30,000. It surprised me. It shouldn't have, because deer ran into one of our cars last year and cost us the deductible. So do you have a number that you could also share with us about how much the insurance outlay is for these 30,000 hits?
Major Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, not currently, but I could contact insurance industry and get a number for you.
Representative Wagenius.
I think it would be helpful if we understood that, because if I'm guessing that was the 30,000, this is a major amount of money. And then I add to, I think we've got 500 deductible. What was the deductible number? I mean, I could multiply 500 out by 30,000. So I think we're talking bigger money here than maybe people realize, and it would be good to understand that. I mean, I have any problem with your bill, but I think the whole context is important for us to understand.
Chairman.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you. I wanted to say on another issue on this bill that just really last night I was thinking about the bill and how things have changed, because, you know, every time we adjourned last year and things have changed since then, and we came up with CETA with chronic wasting in southeastern Minnesota suddenly, and now that's going to be a huge issue, and how this bill might affect, as currently written, someone who hits a deer in that zone or that area and then wants to claim the deer under the first right of refusal and then transport the deer, let's say, to the Twin Cities. And so I asked Mr. Bogus this morning about that, and there's likely going to have to be some provision in this that says except as prescribed by the commissioner for an area that is under special regulation or disease control. So I just wanted to tip the members of this committee off that this bill may look slightly different in order to adjust for this recent finding with CWD, because I mean, right now this would allow someone in Kitson County to hit a deer in Winona, claim the deer, take it to Kitson County, and it potentially could be a problem, no different than if someone shoots a deer and wants to take it from that zone to Kitson County. I'm not picking on Kitson County, I'm giving a big example. So if anybody has any questions on that, you know, I mean, I'll be able to answer them to the limit of my knowledge on that.
Thank you. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll support the bill again. Representative Dill, I do have a question. I think the major begin to answer, and it has to do with the word killed, and the major mentioned about dispatching a conservation officer dispatching a critter. And what are the limits of that? If a deer's, you know, I've been involved in a couple of these things, and they're, you know, crawling away on two legs. Who can dispatch in these situations to arrive at a dead animal?
Representative Purcell, that's a really good one, Major, because when I was on my way duck hunting last fall, a rather large male deer was trashing around on the shoulder of the road in Invergrove Heights, and I turned around, it was with my son, and I thought, we were going duck hunting, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, I wonder if this deer has the ability to get up and go out into the middle of the road, and all we had was birdshot with us. And I thought, what in the world are we going to do? Well, thank goodness, by the time we got turned around and got around, the deer was so weak that it was evident that it couldn't get out in the road. So, Representative Purcell, I'm very interested in the answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, normally the deer are dispatched by law enforcement. We do have, we try not to encourage people to shoot them because of, especially in a metro area, they might have a tendency to run into traffic and then cause more problems. And believe it or not, it's not as easy as some people think to kill an injured deer. And we end up using our majority of the time our shotguns with buckshot because a 40 caliber handgun round won't do it. It'll just make the deer run off some more and sometimes into traffic. So most of the time law enforcement puts them down. We have had cases where if the person will call in the dispatchers, and the county dispatchers and state patrol dispatchers are very good, they're very well rehearsed, and they tell people, you know, don't make it more of a traffic hazard than it already is. And, you know, sometimes if they do crawl off and they're in a very thick wooded area, they do end up crawling off and dying off. But that's a risk we'd rather take than having somebody that's not trained and not aware of the potential other collateral damage that could happen if they try to take care of it themselves and have it run into traffic and cause more problems.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification, you mentioned that, for example, if I had hit a deer, more than likely I would have the first chance to claim it. Under current statute, what would be the situation where the driver wouldn't have the first chance to claim that deer?
Major Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in current statute, there really isn't anything that talks about it. It's just a car hit deer. And there have been... getting back to talking about the different agencies, the wide array of agencies that issue these permits, there are some agencies, for example, that the local fire department might be having a volunteer fire department might be having a ball, so they want to get some car kill deer, and so they'll say, okay, well, this we need some deer for the fireman's banquet. I'm just one of these things. So this would actually clarify that the person that hits the deer does have first right of refusal. So that would it does a lot better job of clarifying issues.
Thank you, Major. Thank you, Representative Dill. We appreciate it. Members, tomorrow we have Office of Energy Security, and then we're going to hear more Game and Fish Bill. I think we have two-line fishing potential discussion and Spearing Northern, so that may be more exciting for some folks. Members, somebody reviewed the minutes?
Yes.
Representative Hancock.
I so move the minutes.
Well, good. Members, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries. Meeting adjourned.